Our region features landscapes ranging from the Pacific Ocean surf to the beginnings of high desert in the Klamath Basin. And connecting them all, our rivers. This would be a very different place without the Sacramento, the Klamath and the Rogue, the Willamette, and so many more. And all the rivers on the Oregon side are gathered in a single book for people who want to swim, to fish, to run whitewater, or just to look. The book is called Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Tim Palmer is the author, and he joined us a while back to talk about California glaciers. Good to have you back in the studio, Tim Palmer.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's great to be here.
So tell us a bit about yourself and what it is you do. And I mean, because you crank out the books, it seems like, on a pretty regular basis about great features of the natural world.
Well, that's what I do. You know, I'm a writer and a photographer. I specialize in rivers. I live in Oregon. And so the rivers of Oregon are the natural thing for me to write about.
Now, you have also done a book that you plopped in front of me here, which I wish I had more time to look at, called Rivers of America. So you've actually not just confined this to the West by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right. I've worked and explored all over the country. And in doing that, one of the things that's really clear to me is that the rivers of Oregon are so special. It's truly an extraordinary suite of streams that we have here. All across our state, from the rainforest to the desert, from the Columbia to the Klamath, there's just nothing like it in the world.
That is a lot of diversity, isn't it, for one state?
It really is. We go from 200 inches of rain down to about 2 to 5 inches in the Alvord Desert, and we've got rivers that reflect everything in between.
I'm surprised to see that you make reference to this being the first field guide to Oregon rivers. Has there been none historically?
You know, there are whitewater guides, some really terrific ones, like Soggy Sneakers, the guidebook of the Willamette Canoe and Kayak Club, and Paddling Oregon. There are fishing guides, some really good ones. But there's no guide to the rivers themselves that really feature these lifelines, these extraordinary places to go visit, and with a focus on their natural history, on what makes them what they are, the features, the life that thrives in them, and that tells you how you can enjoy and find these places by canoeing, by rafting, by drift boating, by fishing, by hiking.
Did you have to make a cutoff for the book
yeah,
size
absolutely.
Of rivers? I mean, you wouldn't go below a certain size or length or something like that?
Yeah, I wanted to write a book that was 800 pages long. You know, the publisher wouldn't agree to that. So we had to keep the price down to $25. So I feature 120 streams. That may seem like a lot, but and that does cover all the major rivers in the state. And I think all the minor ones that are really of special interest or value.
All right. So are there some that are not included? I mean, something that would be...
Well, little streams, sure. I mean, but even many of those I mentioned. So I tried to be as comprehensive as possible within the parameters of a 300-page book.
One of the things I noticed is there's a reference to the Elk River, and I think this is the Elk River near Port Orford.
Right.
But there are actually several Elk Rivers, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of repeat names across the state. You know, there's something like 40 different Eagle Rivers or creeks and so forth. But the Elk River, though, the Elk River is the one that comes into the ocean near Port Orford, which is where I live.
Oh, is it? Okay, good.
That's right. Well, it's my home river.
Well, I noticed we got a pledge this morning on our pledge drive from Langlois, so right in your neighborhood.
That's right near home.
Mm-hmm. So there's quite a long cautionary note up front in the field guide to Oregon rivers. So I guess the note essentially is don't just jump in.
Well, yeah, it's important for everybody to realize what their abilities are. And I tried to, I provided advice that would be safe for people to follow. But, of course, everyone's abilities differ. And so I just wanted to recognize that at the outset. You know, people are responsible for their own safety, and everybody's capabilities and experience levels are different. And I encourage people that don't have a lot of experience to get some training if they're doing something like whitewater boating. But of course, most of the activities that you do along rivers are very safe, like walking or maybe sitting along the river and thinking.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, if there's a breakdown on why people go to rivers, if anybody collects facts and figures on, you know, the percentage of people who go to rivers to do the whitewater rafting or the percentage who go to hike, the percentage who go to just sit and think.
I don't think so. But, you know, all the above, you know, I think most of us enjoy rivers simply by seeing them and by living near them, certainly by drinking from them. You know, 2/3 of our water supplies come from rivers. The rest comes from groundwater, which is intimately linked to that surface flow. So we drink from them, we need them, we fish in them, we hike along them. And they're always just there in the background of our consciousness, as well as Oregonians.
And certainly necessary for life, as has been pointed out many times over. If we didn't have the rivers running nearby.
Yeah, absolutely. These are truly the lifelines of nature and of our state.
So is the guide designed for anyone in particular? As you mentioned, it's not just a whitewater rafting guide. But I mean,
right, it's designed for everybody in particular. But I really feature ways to see these streams by hiking, by boating, and by fishing. So within each of those highlighted rivers, there's a little icon that appears at the end of a general discussion of the natural history and the fish and the conservation issues. There's a little icon that gives you all the tips you need to go there for paddling or for hiking or for fishing.
And I noticed, too, that you've got a pretty good almanac for each of the rivers, too, about just some general facts and figures. Like, for example, I just opened at the Illinois River, 56 miles long, 81 with EF.
Yeah.
What's the EF stand for?
Yeah, the East Fork.
East Fork. Okay, mm-hmm. 81 with East Fork. Okay. Mm-hmm. Average flow, you have cubic feet in here, 1,257 cubic feet per second in the Illinois, which, of course, could be greatly variable. And the size of the watershed, 990 square miles. So little facts and figures for each of the rivers.
Yeah, that's just fundamental data that gives people a clue as to the size and the extent of the river. That data was surprisingly hard to find. There's no gazetteer of Oregon streams that I had to draw from that. I actually had to get GPS specialists from a group called Conservation Geography to develop that data for me in the book.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that is kind of surprising. There's no major cataloging up until this point. So how long did it take to compile all of this? Just the data, let alone the traveling and the photography.
Well, I spent a couple of years working on the book, but I drew from experience going back 30 or 40 years.
Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author of Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. He also joined us earlier to talk about California glaciers, so very big on water in all of its forms, melted and otherwise. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Talk about notable rivers on the Oregon side that you have run across and maybe people don't know about, or assuming you want other people to know about them. Join us on the Exchange with your tales about Oregon rivers with Tim Palmer, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Or you can send us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. There is a ranking of rivers, a ranking chart of rivers by size in Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Columbia is the first on that list, of course. I'm surprised the Rogue is not in the top five. What were the measurements you used to...
Well, the Rogue is the seventh largest river in volume of flow in the state. And so, within the rivers that simply flow in Oregon don't come from other states, it ranks higher than that because, of course, the Columbia and the Snake come with flows that are mostly from other states. But, next to them, we have the Willamette and the Umpqua and then the Rogue. Santiamon Rogue.
All right, the Willamette, of course, the big one entirely within the boundaries of the state of Oregon.
That's so, right.
Let's talk about the Willamette just a bit then, because it's an interesting story. It's not just a big river with a very broad valley and most of Oregon's population clustered around it as well, but lots of tributaries, lots of dams in the whole Willamette system as well.
That's right. Yeah, it's an incredibly diverse river. It does serve most of the people of Oregon. But it's also the Huck Finn River of Oregon. You know, it's a river that you can get on and travel for a week or two. And even though it goes through the heart of agricultural and urban Oregon, what you see from the water on the Willamette about 95% of the time are cottonwood trees. And so you can launch without any great skills in whitewater. You can launch in a canoe or a raft or a drift boat in Eugene or even above there. You can float for 2 weeks and camp on gravel bars and campsites of the Willamette River Greenway and resupply at little towns along the way and just have the terrific time of your life floating down that river the whole way to Willamette Falls in Portland.
Where you are obligated to leave the water.
You have to stop there. It's a 40-foot drop. It's actually one of the more amazing riverine features of Oregon that very few people know about. It's the biggest waterfall in the West in volume of flow, second only to Niagara.
Really?
In the country, Willamette Falls, and just above Portland, at the head of tide. And from the top, which you can see from Highway 99, it looks like a dam because the upper edge of the falls has been dammed. But when you see it from the bottom, which actually you can only see by paddling upstream from the mouth of the Clackamas River, it's just a phenomenal sight, this 40-foot waterfall that comes cascading down in about seven different segments of river. You kind of feel like you're at the base of Victoria Falls or something like that. It's truly an amazing sight. right there in the Portland urban area.
I'm still trying to figure out the engineering, how they managed to put the dam right there at the falls and the paper mill now closed at that site as well.
That's right. It was quite the industrial corridor. I mean, it kind of looks like an old, two-century-old New England river town with these industries right along, most of them defunct now. But the dam was built, of course, long ago to divert water off to the sides for hydropower.
So, you know, given all the rivers that you've had a chance to see, and I gather you're speaking from experience paddling from the mouth of the Clackamas up to Willamette Falls.
Right. Oh, yes, yeah, certainly.
You've done that. So given, I mean, all the experiences you've had with Oregon rivers, it's sort of like picking a most beautiful child or something from your kids. I mean, yeah, is there a greatest river experience, one that you just want to do over and over again on some Oregon river?
You know, the favorite river question is a tough one. Usually I answer that by saying it's the river where I am. You know, so right now it's going to be the Rogue. Of course, there's nothing like the Rogue. You know, it's this classic Western River expedition that we have, and here we are at the headwaters of it. And, you know, my wife and I have done it over and over, and we will never tire of it. But other favorites are the Umpqua. The Umpqua is actually the longest river trip you can do on the Pacific coast. You can put in on the South Umpqua at Teller and float for 175 miles to the ocean, with only two big rapids that you have to carry around, no dams. It's an extraordinary river in the whole perspective of the West. The John Day is like that. The North Fork John Day and the John Day run for 200 miles until you hit the backwater of the Dalles Dam, of John Day Dam on the Columbia. So those are real favorites. The Chetco is right up at the top of my list. Many people don't know about the Chetco. But it's a major river that runs into the ocean at Brookings on our south. It's just over the mountains from here. It's the wildest river on the west coast south of the Olympic Mountains. The upper 30 miles are wilderness. Two-thirds of the river is national forest and national wild and scenic river. There's almost no development on the river till you get near to sea level. It's an extraordinary river, crystal clear water with salmon and steelhead still running in it. And interestingly, threats of gold mining as well. So that's one of those conservation issues that I discuss in the book.
The Chetco has been talked about a lot of late because of that, because of mining threats. And let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Tim Palmer, the author of Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. It's a broad look at rivers all across the state of Oregon and all the many different environments that the state has to offer. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with comments or questions or your own tales of adventures along rivers in Oregon. 800-838-3760 is our phone number anywhere in our listening area. Or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the Chetco and the threats of potential mining activity there. How long is the Chetco? Because it does seem to be sort of out of people's awareness because there really aren't communities on it other than Brookings.
It's just a wild place. It's 60 miles long. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual in that it rises in the Siskiyou Mountains, and instead of flowing out of the mountains to the ocean the way most rivers do fairly directly, the Chetco just wanders all over the place. You know, it runs north, and it runs west, and it runs south, and then finally again west to the ocean. So it has this very circuitous route all through wilderness until the lower sections of the river.
We have an email here from Barbara in Grants Pass. She said, "You've seen most of the rivers in Oregon and America. It seems like the rivers flowing out of and through southwest Oregon's Kalmiopsis Wilderness area are extra special and stand out nationally, especially with regard to the quality of their waters. Does that seem like it's the case to you?"
Yeah. Let me be very clear about this. There is nothing in the world like our Siskiyou Mountain rivers right here in southern Oregon. These streams, there are a whole suite of them that flow off of the Siskiyou Mountains, the Kalmiopsis Wilderness, like spokes in a wheel. We have the Bald Face Creek and the North Fork of the Smith flowing north into California. It becomes California's most extraordinary undammed river. We have Rough and Ready Creek flowing off the east side into the Illinois, which is a classic wild river of the West before it hits the Rogue. Then we have the Chetco running north and then west. Nothing like these in the world. They come from wild country. They're crystal clear. And because of the unusual geology here, which dates to formation of mountains beneath the sea and then those mountains rising up and being jumbled and mixed incomparably by earthquakes and seismic activity, because of that unusual geology, we have really unusual plant life along these rivers that people from all over the world come to botanists, come from all over the world to see. So there's nothing like this suite of rivers that we have right in our backyard, yet they go unrecognized by many people.
And in fact, the Illinois is the home to Darlingtonia, isn't it? Isn't that the major species there? It's one of the really interesting species of plants there.
But there are many, you know, because of the unusual geology, there are just a lot of diversity of plant life.
You mentioned Rough and Ready Creek, which people may know from traveling from Medford and Grants Pass down US 199 to California. They not only get to see the Smith River, but they get to see Rough and Ready Creek as well and cross the Illinois a couple of times. The Rough and Ready Creek, it looks alien when you go over that wayside just south of Rough and Ready Lumber, south of Cave Junction. And it just looks like nothing really grows there. So what's going on geologically for the folks who don't really understand?
Yeah, it's a really unusual mix of minerals that are not particularly hospitable to most of the plants that normally thrive in our area, like giant Douglas fir trees or western red cedar. But because of that, a lot of really unusual plants thrive that can accommodate the unusual minerals that are in the soil. So what you see right there is kind of a depauperate soil. It looks depauperate, but actually it's full of diversity of life. And as you go upstream, that changes. And, of course, you do get into forests and a lot of other kinds of vegetation.
The Rough and Ready Creek actually flows into the Illinois, is that right?
That's right.
And the Illinois itself is quite an interesting river for a number of reasons, which you point out well in the chapter on that one. Tell us about the Illinois and some of the things that really make it unique.
Yeah, well, it starts, of course, in the Siskiyou Mountains. It runs through some developed areas in Selma and Cave Junction region, the high valley there. But then it drops into a canyon that is one of the river runners' really hot spots throughout the West. I mean, every experienced whitewater boater wants to do the Illinois River because you launch there at Oak Flat below Selma and you go for 30 miles through total wilderness in the Calmiopsis and down to the Rogue with some really big rapids like Greenwald, what rafters call a class 5 rapid. It's very difficult. But it's just an extraordinary place. It runs only during the high water, so you run that in the springtime on big flows, or in the summer if you're in an inflatable and you want to get out and drag the boat quite a bit. So it's a difficult river to see, really unusual. You can hike in, but the trails are pretty rough and rugged too. So, you know, it's not one of the more accessible, user-friendly streams, but really one of the most beautiful and one of the wildest.
High reward, and certainly for rafters, can be a high risk, too, because the hydraulics can change suddenly.
That's right. The Illinois is incredibly flashy. You can go from a few hundred cubic feet per second up to 16,000. And so anybody who's caught in there during a winter storm has a serious problem.
We're talking to Tim Palmer about his book, Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Because of the pledge drive going on simultaneously, we're shuffling the hour around a little bit. Writer's Almanac will be heard in about a quarter of an hour. But you can join Tim as we talk about Oregon rivers and experiences on those rivers. 800-838-3760 is the number to call the Jefferson Exchange anywhere in our listening area. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been focusing on, obviously, there's fascinating things to talk about in southwestern Oregon. But here's a good chance then to talk about Oregon geology on the west side generally. And as you point out, north and south of the Coquille River, some real differences.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And east and west, there are great differences. You know, we have the Coast Range, which runs the whole length of the state north to south, and rivers that flow off it are rainforest rivers. The Coquille is the largest basin. The Nehalem is the largest river that come entirely from the Coast Range. These are streams that are famous for salmon and steelhead. Many of them are still undammed and unpolluted, and they've all been heavily logged, but now many of them are beginning to recover from that era when logging was very uncontrolled and damaging to our rivers. So that's a special suite of rivers. The Cascade Mountain rivers are extraordinary, coming into the Willamette, the tributaries to the Willamette. Great streams like the Umpqua, the North Umpqua, the Clackamas, the Santiam, the Mackenzie. And they're very different in that they're snow-fed rivers, so they continue to run well into the summer down into the Willamette Valley and then, of course, into the Willamette itself, which we talked about. The east side drains into the Deschutes, which is a quintessential desert river, whereas the Willamette winds through fertile farmlands. The Deschutes cuts and rips through a raw volcanic landscape through canyons to the Columbia. And then beyond that, into the desert with the John Day coming from the Blue Mountains and closed basin rivers in the south that just flow into deserts and evaporate. And then finally, the Snake, which is the 12th largest river in North America, the largest tributary to Columbia by far. It runs through Hell's Canyon, which is our second deepest canyon nationwide.
Well, you mentioned rivers that actually, and I'd forgotten this until you reminded me in the book, but the Chehuacan, for example, is a river that flows into the Great Basin and just poof.
That's right, and it's the only one that still supplies a lake that never dries up. It's the only lake that since the Ice Age has not dried up at some time in historic times.
So are we talking about
Chehuacan
Lake Eber?
Chehuacan is still, kind of mimics what the great Ice Age rivers once did. The Chehuacan kind of gets my reward as the least known but most beautiful river in Oregon. Hardly anybody ever sees this river because it's out in that kind of netherland of central Oregon, mm-hmm. where few people go.
And Lake Ebert is in Lake County, correct?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, okay. So what are some of the places along the Chehuacan or the Chehuacan? I'm not sure.
Well, the headwaters come from the Gerhardt Mountain Wilderness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a pine forest, fir forest, dropping down into this gorgeous ponderosa pine savanna above the little town of Paisley. And that's where the river is its most beautiful.
So are there any places that, I mean, given all the rivers you've seen, is there any place that just feels the most alien to you, like you're standing on a river on a different planet or something?
Oh, you know, the Owyhee is really an unusual river in this respect. It's in the far southeastern corner of the state. Some of the wildest desert country in America drains into the canyons, the West Little Owyhee, the Forks of the Owyhee, and then through these remarkable 2,000-foot deep canyons of basalt rock that are deeper than they are wide. And, you know, alien in the sense that there's nothing like it, and it's bizarre, and it's very stark, but just incredibly beautiful. And you realize how gorgeous the unusual river can be when you're on the Owyhee.
Much more to talk about with Tim Palmer and the Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Don't forget, it's our fun drive, 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Back with Tim in a minute five. . 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're spending most of this hour talking to Tim Palmer about his Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. He actually took a look at just about every major river in the state of Oregon and cataloged it in this book. And as he points out, it couldn't be 800 pages. The publisher said no to that. Ends up about 300, but very easy to take around with you if you're exploring Oregon rivers either on foot or by boat or fishing, or doing any of the activities you can do along rivers. Join us on the Exchange if you'd like to talk to Tim. We have questions, comments available from you, and we hope you'll share stories about Oregon rivers as well. 800-838-3760. 800-838-3760. Our phone number, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Grab your headphones and let's take a call here from Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
I just wondered if Tim has an opinion or a prognosis in terms of which of Oregon's snow-fed rivers is the most vulnerable to climate change.
All right, so which of those snow-fed rivers might be in the most trouble? Good question. Thanks for that, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Of all the problems affecting our rivers, climate change is the most universal in that it's going to be affecting streams everywhere. And a really interesting stream in that regard is the South Umpqua. The South and the North Umpqua are twin streams. They both join together below Roseburg to make the main stem Umpqua. It's the fifth largest river in Oregon. And the South Umpqua's headwaters are much lower than the North Umpqua's. Hmm. So it makes a wonderful comparison study. The North Umpqua will retain a lot of its snowmelt, a wonderful ice-cold groundwater that comes from the high cascades where snowmelt sinks quickly into the volcanic landscape. The South Umpqua is lower in elevation, so it has way less snowmelt, way less groundwater infiltration. So it drops much faster and sooner, and it warms up a lot easier. So just by comparing those two streams over time, we will be able to tell what some of the devastating effects of climate change will be. We've already seen that in that the Umpqua is much warmer. The South Umpqua has also been just really hammered by clear-cut logging over the years. they both have, but even more than the North Umpqua. And so its salmon and steelhead are already in way more trouble. But we're going to see even an aggravation of those problems just because of climate change.
Just as things get warmer.
But virtually every stream is going to be affected by this. And the some of those that will be the most interesting and the most valuable will be the streams flowing off the north slopes of our high mountains, such as the Hood River, which flows north off Mount Hood, whereas the Sandy flows off the west and south side. Those streams will be colder. The higher elevation streams will be colder. These will become very important refuges for our cold water fish. And so so they deserve protection. But, of course, the ones that are lower in elevation with less snowmelt deserve protection even more. I think what climate change means is that everything river conservationists have been trying to do for the last 50 years, which includes floodplain protection so that the stream front remains in open space with trees shading the water, groundwater infiltration areas are protected, linkages are important between protected areas. All these things will be even more important as the climate changes, so that we'll have to try to do what we've been trying to do, only just do it more and faster and better.
Bruce in Ashland sends an email in. He wants to know how we quantify the benefits of the rivers economically to get people to protect the economy that is based upon the rivers being in good shape.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too, because it's so difficult to do. You know, we can't live without our rivers. We know that because we need them for water supply. More and more, we're seeing the economy of Oregon transitioning from commodity industries like logging to recreational services. And, I mean, that change has been dramatic. And so it's important to realize the values that our rivers have that way. And a few economic studies have been done in this regard across the country. But, you know, it's just really hard to actually get a handle in terms of numbers on that.
I imagine a few people have tried that, because you're right that we're turning from a focus on the value of things economically in terms of extraction. What can we take out of the rivers? What can we take out of the headwater country? And moving toward analysis of ecosystem services. I don't know if you've heard that term before, but we've had a few people on talking about that before, where you quantify, okay, we get this good out of everything remaining pristine. We get nice fresh water. We get habitat for animals that we need for, you know, everything gets quantified in the ecosystem services.
That's
model.
Right. Yeah, one of the interesting studies that has been done there is actually on the Colorado River Basin, because it's attracted more interest of this kind. They found that the river-centric economy there is worth many billion. I think the figure was $9 billion, and growing exponentially.
We have another question here from Debbie in Talent. Wants to know, what is your vessel of choice, Tim?
Yeah,
when you visit rivers, what's your boat?
I love swimming.
It's a human body.
I'm kind of a canoeist, you know. The canoe is my favorite craft, and I love whitewater canoeing, but I also love rafting. You know, I have a raft with a rowing frame, which I use on big rivers and really long trips. And my wife kayaks. That works really well, too. And you know, walking is the universal way to see rivers, and no place has trails along rivers like Oregon does. We have more riverfront paths and great places to see rivers that way than anybody else's. So all you have to do is walk.
You know, I know I've been asking for some superlatives, and it's hard to say what's the most beautiful river, and it's pretty much the river where you are right now, I suppose. But is there an ugliest river? Is there a place you just went, blech?
An ugliest river?
I suppose it might be a nice polluted stretch of the Willamette or something.
Well, yeah, but you know, they're never ugly, though. I mean, if you want a really stark industrial landscape, look at the lower Willamette in the shipping corridor below Portland, where there are giant freighters sitting next to the water, and of course, there are toxics in the riverbed there from a history of abuse and pollution from the pulp mills upstream and from other toxic waste producers. But still, you know, it's beautiful in its own way.
It is. Let's take a call here from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer, the author of Field Guide to Oregon Rivers.
Thank you. I'm sure your book is very interesting, Mr. Palmer. One of the things that individuals can do to help water quality would be to stop using all these antibacterial washing products and this sort of thing. The reason for that is that, especially here in the Willamette Valley, is that our wastewater treatment industries use bacteria, anaerobic bacteria, to treat the wastewater. And therefore, it's already become a problem in some areas that these deluge of antibacterial products are having an adverse effect on these anaerobic bacteria.
Oh, okay. Interesting point to bring up. Thanks for that, Ann.
That's really great, Ann. That's important to do. And there are a lot of things the individual can do like that. There are also things that we need to do as a society to improve our rivers and improve their quality. One deals with mining threats. Because of the mining law of 1872, which was written, you know, before there were airplanes or before there was national forest land even existed, we're still operating, our country's still operating under a mining law that predated any of the modern mining industrial equipment. And so many of the rivers on federal lands are vulnerable to incredible devastation from poorly regulated mining. All you have to do is Google the Riddle Mine or the Formosa Mine and look at a map of the strip mining that could happen on streams like our own Rough and Ready Creek, our own North Fork of the Smith, our own Chetco with some gold mining threats. So mining is one of the big threats to our rivers, and another one still remains poorly regulated logging on private industrial forest lands, because our State Forest Practices Act offers fewer controls than any of our surrounding states do. We're still vulnerable to things like landslides from vast areas of clear-cut logging on private industrial land that are poorly regulated with inadequate setbacks from the water.
All right, challenges certainly exist then, but those are cataloged as well. You do list them very, very carefully in the Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Tim Palmer, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about your book, and best of luck in future endeavors.
Hey, thanks for letting me be here. It's great to talk with you.
We'll talk to you down the road. Take care.